Evans Administrator, et cetera, versus MACCO Materials Handling Group, Inc., James J. O'Keefe IV, Steve Ron Brown, Edward Fisher, Appellate Counsel, Frank A. Friedman, Mark Lee Loftus, Francis J. Gray, Jr., Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jay O'Keefe, and I represent the appellant, Rhonda Evans, the administrator of her husband's estate. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this products liability case, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Ms. Evans after a 6-day trial, finding that NACA's defective parking brake caused her husband's death. The trial court set that verdict aside on the ground that Mr. Evans was contributorily negligent as a matter of law, essentially faulting him for relying on the parking brake to serve its explicit function of holding the lift truck on an incline. The trial court had some subsidiary complaints, but they don't hold up under the standard of review. On this record, the issues of contributory negligence and proximate causation raised classic questions of fact for the jury. And the trial court itself acknowledged that rational people could have differed about the reasonableness of any one of Mr. Evans' individual actions. And on this record, even that's an understatement. 5 simple facts would have led a reasonable jury conclude that Mr. Evans had behaved prudently. First, he received hours of classroom instruction before he and practical instruction on the truck before he ever tried to operate it. Second, he tried to operate it only at the express direction of his employer, who was responsible for his training and certification. Third, he indisputably set the parking brake. So this isn't an illusory park situation like Ford Motor Company. The applicable industry standard required that parking brake to be capable of holding a full load of 7,700 pounds on a 15% incline. Here we had no load on an incline of, at most, about 12%. Fourth, a sign right next to the parking brake said that an alarm would sound if Evans left his seat without applying the parking brake. When he got up, that alarm didn't sound. Fifth, the parking brake initially held on the incline. Only after that did Mr. Evans come around behind the lift truck. And when he did so, he relied on that parking brake to serve its explicit purpose. A jury could find that was reasonable behavior. Rational people rely on safety devices to do their job. It's no exaggeration to say that happens millions of times a day.
Can I interrupt and ask you this question? Shifting gears from contrib to design flaws, can you precisely state exactly what the theory of the design flaw was? I mean, I've read all the briefs, but it's a lot of things floating in the air, but I'm trying to get a synthesis of what the exact design flaw was.
The plaintiff's expert faulted the parking brake because it could be adjusted by an operator, not a mechanic, without any tools. So he proved that up primarily by reference to a safer alternative design, which would have been a set screw.
So an adjustable parking brake on an industrial piece of equipment is negligent design?
An adjustable parking brake that can be adjusted by the operator without tools on these facts is a negligent design.
So if you need tools to adjust it, why does that make it safe? And if you don't need tools, it's unsafe.
The theory here, Your Honor, is that requiring the use of tools is a sufficient deterrent to the operator to keep them from inadvertently adjusting the parking brake out of adjustment or from making an ill-advised attempt to adjust it that backfires.
Well, was it inadvertent or was it deliberate?
And let me try and answer that by backing up and giving a little context.
And let me just add, just to my, because it looked like, I mean, it takes 50 pounds of force, which is a lot of force to pull this thing, and almost the totality of the plant's on level ground. So reading between the lines, it appears that some of these operators, just to make their life easier, maybe just adjusted it so it wasn't as much effort as you're stopping and going. And so that's what they were doing, as opposed to nonchalantly, you know, turning it for no... accidentally.
Right, Your Honor, and that sort of gets at the point of Mr. Mallett's criticism here, is that that shouldn't be a thing that they're able to do. They shouldn't be able to just disable the parking brake to make their lives easier if that happened. And when we get to the question of inadvertence, there's a couple different ways to inadvertently take this thing out of adjustment, right? There's the nonchalant kind of twist of the handle that you were talking about, Justice McCullough. But then consider the testimony of Julian Lindsay, who's the most experienced operator at this plant, right? And he was never trained, because nobody at this plant was trained, on how to adjust the parking brake. They weren't supposed to do that. They were supposed to leave that to the mechanics. Julian Lindsay's been around for a while. He's spoken to the mechanics. He finds out how you do it, and he takes it upon himself to do that, except he's not taught that you adjust this and then you take it to an appropriate incline, you see if it holds, and that's how you test it. He's told that you test it by feel. You see if it feels like it's firm enough. And you don't take it to the incline. You don't do the appropriate testing. So what you have here is somebody who's found out how to adjust the parking brake. He thinks he's putting it into adjustment based on feel, but he has no idea. He doesn't have a pressure gauge.
Position is that the manufacturer has to design a product that eliminates the possibility of misuse.
No, Your Honor. Our position is that to a reasonable degree, the manufacturer has to design a product that it doesn't have to eliminate the possibility of misuse, but it has to impose sufficient safety precautions on the industrial equipment to make it reasonable, not unreasonable.
Right, and the plaintiff's expert in this case had a theoretical safety design that would have been better, right? That's what he testified to. This theoretical safety design would have been better.
Your Honor, he had he pointed to three reasonable alternative designs. One was not theoretical;
right.
It was actually put into practice. It's the set screw.
But nobody had ever used.
That's not correct, Your Honor. Mitsubishi Caterpillar put that into production. There were photographs of the set screw and schematics.
After?
No, Your Honor. It's
ambiguous.
Can you point me
to the appendix page on that?
Your Honor, Mallett's testimony on direct is that he thought this came about around the turn of the century, 2002. In cross-examination, it became clear that there's some fuzziness about when it was actually put into practice, but it was indisputably feasible. Both the defendant and Frederick Mallett testified, and that's Mr. Couch's testimony and Mr. Mallett's testimony. I can get you the exact appendix pages on rebuttal. But this was indisputable.
I've read all that testimony, and I didn't read it that way, so that's why I'm asking the question. But
Okay. Also,
can you tell me what the objective safety standard is that was violated here? Objective safety standard.
Okay. Two points in response to that, Your Honor. First, the industry standard, ANSI 56.1, was...
Where did your expert talk about an industry standard? Can you point me to those pages?
Your Honor, he factored it. He spoke about the industry standard. He explained that, as designed, this parking brake complied with the industry standard, but then he explained that this was a performance standard, not a design standard. And so it explained that the parking brake has to perform within certain parameters. It doesn't specify a design of one type or another.
But you see, what's happening in our conversation with you and what's happened in this case is, at some point, there's got to be some framework to throw an expert's opinion of unreasonableness against. It doesn't have to be dispositive, but it has to be something. And industry standards and objective codes and ANSI's and all the rest of those things are relevant to inform that. What framework do you give us other than the expert says that I could have designed a better thing than this? Because that can't be enough if that's all it is.
Well, a couple points in response to that, Your Honor. I agree that industry standards and government regulations are relevant to this inquiry. I don't think they're utterly dispositive. In fact, there's case law from
across
the country that says they're not dispositive.
But we got to have something.
And so under footnote 14 from Walters, we have reasonable consumer expectations. And then we have just the classic risk utility analysis that underpins all of negligence law, right? And so a negligent design claim.
But I wonder if reasonable consumer expectations is really just another way of saying the learned hand utility thing, because We don't hire people to do the learned hand utility formula. We want to find out what the industry, the courts, that is, once the industry believes the utility standard is.
Well, and there's significant overlap there, right? Because if you think about what reasonable consumer expectations are doing in that analysis, mm-hmm. right, you have the minimum government standards, you have the industry standards, and then reasonable consumer expectations are the backstop for when society demands more than what those apply. And then the risk utility analysis, which is now the dominant form nationwide of proving design defect, does something very, very similar. Is this design reasonable?
But how do we moderate that? I mean, because anybody can go to the stand and say, well, I think the proper risk utility ratio is X or Y or Z. There's got to be some rule.
You moderate it the way that the third restatement requires. You prove a safer alternative design, which is what Mr. Mallett tried to do here.
Well, that's a dangerous argument because I don't know the Virginia cases have ever gone quite that far.
Well, and Your Honor, until Walters, Virginia cases hadn't spoken about reasonable consumer expectations either. But once we start formulating and developing the law in this area, we do have to, like you said, clarify some of the tests. And one of the tests is reasonable consumer expectations. Another is risk utility analysis.
So as long as there's a safer way of doing it, I mean, is that enough under your analysis?
Your Honor, it's objective. We're talking about reasonableness. We're pointing to a thing that exists in the real world. It can be enough under our analysis on the right set of facts, and we believe that this record provides the right set of facts to establish that either as a risk utility / safer alternative design test or coming in under reasonable consumer expectations as evidence of other industry practices.
One last question, then, and help me think this through. If that were the paradigm, then we would go to every single industry, every manufacturing industry. We find the best manufacturer who spent the highest R&D and did it perfectly, and everyone else gets sued because everyone below them is not reaching that level for whatever reason. That can't be the right answer, can it?
Oh, that's not what would happen, Your Honor, because the jury's there to test whether that's a reasonable theory. I mean, it's hypothetically a person could get sued, but that lawsuit's going nowhere. If we start suing every car manufacturer because Tesla has this fantastic autopilot system, right? Mm-hmm. And so robot-driven cars are safer than ape-driven cars. And so every car manufacturer who's not using the top-of-the-market artificial intelligence system is negligent on that theory. Those cases fail.
Well, it sounds like you're leading us in that direction with the nature of your argument.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It sounds like you're leading us in that direction with the nature of the argument. Why couldn't a jury say that if your thesis were right? Why couldn't a jury say, look, there are other cars that are slightly better in the safety feature, therefore the one that's not is negligent design?
Well, Your Honor, because juries are there to decide fact questions like reasonableness, and we trust them to decide what's reasonable. What I just posited is a patently unreasonable argument. And we have to, at some point, rely on juries to decide what is or isn't reasonable. We've got, in Walters, we've got a set of tests. Two of them, I think we agree, are relevant but not necessarily dispositive. Government standards are minimum standards. Industry standards are set by industry. They're not fully protected with consumers.
It begs the question, there's got to be still some objective framework for reasonable consumer expectations, and courts across the nation have been groping with this. We're not the first one to try to figure this out.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and the restatement points to safer alternative design as a backstop, as an objective standard.
Counsel, your expert's opinion was that the design was defective and unreasonably dangerous and that it failed to eliminate misuse by the operator. And then your expert goes on to talk about this screw design that doesn't eliminate misuse. And it talks about a second design, not getting into the theoretical, that doesn't eliminate misuse. So how could his opinion ever get to the jury when the things that he points out don't eliminate misuse?
Well, Your Honor, it gets back to the colloquy I had with Justice McCullough about degrees of inadvertence. If you have a set screw that requires the use of tools to adjust it, and you're working in this case,
but it doesn't eliminate misuse because the operator could use the tool.
The operator in that case would be fully intentionally using the tool, and if the operator comes in, I agree, if the operator comes in and intentionally disables the parking brake, if he comes in and cuts the cables, takes the handle off so it won't work,
no, he just unscrews the screw.
But if he comes in and unscrews, if he goes under the cowl with a screwdriver and takes the device apart.
He can't casually do it the way you can with this device.
But the opinion was that this one failed to eliminate misuse. But the screw design and the other design, which I'm sorry I don't recall, can't articulate it, neither of those eliminated misuse.
Your Honor, I think that read in the context of his whole testimony, Mr. Mallett is not saying that the manufacturer has to categorically eliminate the possibility of misuse. I don't think the judge would have let him testify to that. I think read in the context of everything else he has to say, we're talking about deterring operators from making adjustments that they're not qualified to make or that they're not even intentionally making. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, you have 10 seconds.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing NMHG NACO Materials Holding Group. Mark Loftus and Francis Gray Jr. are with me at counsel's table. I'd like to address one thing that my colleague said a second ago, just at the outset, and that is that this wasn't inadvertent. This was, and part of it is, Mr. Mallett's only criticism here was that it was operator adjustable. And he said that about 8 different times. And we quoted that in our footnote, footnote 4 in our brief. And at page 453, he even said, let me cut to the chase. It's not, my complaint is that it's operator adjustable. And when they tried to expand to some other things, at pages 364 and 65, the court ruled, hey, you can't go there because all you disclosed was, don't let operators adjust it, okay? Now, this was 4 turns disabled. It's undisputed. This wasn't inadvertent, but inadvertent was never his theory. This is a new attempt to get away from the theory that they had, which is that it was a set screw that prohibited the user, the operator, from making changes. Because
isn't there at least some ambiguity, though, in that? I mean, I'm with you that in a number of places the expert expressly said it has to be a mechanic who does it, but then opposing counsel points at other parts where maybe there's a little more ambiguity.
Well, there again, this was intentional. This wasn't inadvertent, and that's important. And the pages that say
what I'm getting at is the mechanic has to be the one who adjusts, and that's the theory versus.
That's his theory.
Versus it can't be. A user with tools could adjust.
Well, and let me say this. What made this interesting and unusual is that Mr. Mallett's theory was that the set screw design was only fixable by a mechanic. He believed that the set screw couldn't be fixed by an operator. And he specifically said that throughout his testimony on direct. That's his theory. Now, what then happens is that on cross, at JA 454 to 467, he's suddenly confronted by manuals from his own company that showed that the operators were taught and shown in the manuals how to adjust the set screw. As Justice Powell said, all you do is remove the screw. And it turns out that operator adjustments were encouraged and were fully contemplated and taught in the manual, JA 466 to 68.
Counsel, let me ask the question that follows up on Justice McCullough's unintended use. He does, when he is disclosing what his opinion is, talk about intended or unintended use. And there do seem to be within this transcript times when one could read in that perhaps he's talking about an inadvertent bump of the brake, which is why the screw would preclude an inadvertent bump. Why isn't that enough to take it to the jury?
Okay, again, and that's why I'm saying it's so important that didn't happen in this case. In this case, it was 4 turns completely disengaged, and nobody disagreed with that.
So the point there is causation, but for causation.
In this case, that it's kind of like the Kendrick versus Bass, the whole versus the surface. I mean, that isn't what happened in this case. But, so, yes. But the point is, here, at 1092 to 1093, 1042, 845, this wasn't an inadvertence. Somebody did it. Now, Mr. Mallett has a theory on who did it. Mr. Mallett, we're hard on him in a lot of places, and rightly so, but he says that he can't understand why this would ever happen. Why would you let someone reduce it to zero? Well, we answered that. At JA 834, you reduce it to zero for maintenance and repair. And this vehicle had returned from VBS that same day. They are the repair people. And Mr. Mallett thinks probably this was the first user after VBS returned it at 491 to 493, and he just didn't check. And they returned it, and plaintiff settled with VBS. And I'm sorry that settlement order isn't in the joint appendix, but it's in the record at 1194 to 1201. So what you have here is, going back to what's wrong with this. What's wrong with this vehicle? Nothing. Even Mr. Mallett says this worked great. This brake worked great. Except for one thing, it was disengaged. Someone shut it off. It's like a light bulb.
Can I interrupt for a second? It seems like we're talking about two separate things. One is there's nothing wrong with it. There's no design defect. And secondly, his theory that there is a design defect because you need a lock screw or something like that. But he still has to prove that had there been the better lock screw system, that would have prevented the accident. And there's no even assertion of that, much less evidence of it.
Correct, but plus, you know, they're trying to act like cross-examination didn't happen. His set screw didn't prevent anything, except that you had to remove the screw. His entire opening testimony was basically, don't let the operators do this. And at JA-364, that's what the court ruled when they tried to expand. And he says, let me cut to the chase. My theory is, don't let operators do it. The set screw plan, let the operators do it. And here's the bottom line. He admitted the lift truck met ANSI and OSHA standards, government and industry. He admitted it. We also showed it met industrial custom. Operator adjustability was the prevailing practice, JA 1035 to 38, 1115, 16. Mr. Mallett, in fact, acknowledged in 2003 ours was the number one lift truck in America, and he conceded no standard anywhere in the world criticized operator adjustable brakes at 477-78.
Well, where do we go with the argument that's got to be at minimum partially right, that juries can go beyond objective industry standards and conclude under their own risk utility formula that, I'm sorry, but the whole industry needs to move forward on this?
Well, what this court has said is it has to be based on more than just a say-so. And I think all courts really have said that. I mean, let's look at the consumers here. You know, Mr. Mallett didn't say consumers were clamoring for non-adjustable brakes. It was the exact opposite. And it's notable, he was in charge of customer service for 4 years. He didn't list one customer complaint. To the contrary, the evidence was, and we put it on, industrial buyers loved adjustable brakes. They were field tested and feedback was positive. IP Weyerhaeuser loved the brake and specifically ordered it, 1190 to 94. They ordered 500 a year because they liked this model. And notably, the adjustable brake was safer than having workers driving with an out-of-adjustment brake. And it was also efficient because workers don't like taking these trucks out of service every time the brake needs a tweak or an adjustment.
Can I interrupt one more time?
Sure.
So if you've got the adjustable brake and you twist it to confirm its tightness, that means every operator can always ensure in any given moment that he's got a tight brake. Whereas if you've got a lock screw brake that he can't touch, he pulls it back, he may or may not have a tight brake. He has no idea.
Well, even Mr. Mallett said it wouldn't have helped in this case. I think it's JA 516. He said it assumes that the brake isn't completely disengaged.
So in this very case, if it had been completely disengaged as it was, but the lock screw was in, he'd have pulled the thing back and said, okay, I'm good to go.
Well, and the problem is, it does come back, and I do want to just say, and this is sort of a segue to contrib, but, you know, this brake did meet industry standards, government standards, industry customs and practice, and consumer expectations. And just to go back to your question, because I did get a little far afield, I think it's possible for an entire industry to be negligent. And let's be clear, JA-468, Mr. Malik could name one forklift in 2003, class 4 or 5, that wasn't unreasonably dangerous under his theory, because everybody used operator-adjustable brakes. He said everything was wrong. Now, an entire industry can be negligent, but the expert has to have some support for his opinion beyond his own say-so. Maybe there's some literature. Maybe other countries have adopted something. Maybe there's evidence of numerous injuries. Maybe there are customers clamoring for a change. None of that is here. This is just say-so. And that's what this court, you know, the administrator says in their brief, that it would be a sea change not to let the jury be the gatekeeper on that, and not to let Mr. Mallett testify and let the jury sort it out. We think that's inconsistent with Walters, Duncan, Turner, Logan, Featherall. You know, we just think that those cases are right and they should be upheld. Now
in this case, didn't the jury find for the plaintiff, and the reason that it's here is that the judge then post-verdict found contributory negligence?
The judge found that that ruling was plainly wrong, and
but then did not in any way set aside the jury's findings on the other issues. If there's contributory negligence, that's the only one.
He set it aside on contrib. But again, he found, and I don't think we've heard anything otherwise, there was no evidence of anything but say-so. I mean, there's no evidence of anything to show, except for Mr. Mallett's opinion, that in 2003, when this truck was issued, that anybody, you know, anybody was using the...
But he did say that design was readily available.
He said it, but nobody wanted it. I mean, you know, the fact is, what they're kind of reverse engineering and saying, hey, this is possible to do. It's sort of like if there had been a car accident, somebody using a car at 55 miles per hour, and he's like saying, you know, this wouldn't have happened if the car could only go 20 miles per hour. This would have never happened. And the problem is, nobody wants that car. He says 100% of the existing lift trucks out there in 2003 are unreasonably dangerous.
So it sounds as though what you're saying is that the reasonable consumer expectations test has to be applied variably. And if you're attacking the entire industry, you've got to have a pretty good basis for doing it. If you have an industry that has mixed use, then maybe juries can decide which of the industry subsets they think is the better subset. But something more is required if you're attacking the entire industry.
I'm saying you have to have something more consumer or something. He had nothing except really a misconception that the set screw, he just... His entire theory, it turned out he was wrong. And in that uh-oh moment, everything that he said after pages 1054 to 1067, when it was suddenly revealed that even those operators could just take out a screw and they were encouraged to do so, his own company, this is his company, Mitsubishi Caterpillar, was saying, let the operators do it. And I do want to go back to just mention that Mr. Mallett also said that this letting him on this truck was a misuse of the truck. He was not an intended user of the truck. That's JA 502. And they float the suggestion that he was virtually trained to to use it. He was not. Mr. Lindsay, at 7:23 and 11:19, it's revealed he had very minimal practical training on the vehicle. That's why he didn't have any feel or practical experience. When Mr. Lindsay got on that vehicle after the accident, it was
not to mention around. The training they did have was poor.
The training that they did have, which was put on, again, I think, by VBS and IP, and the judge said it wasn't, you know, that they make excuses for the training, but the fact is he didn't finish it. They say you could finish it in one day. Well, that's not right. You had 2 weeks of practical evaluation, and that's OSHA. But even the man who said you might do it in a day, and he was talking about classrooms, said, you absolutely can't be on that truck if you're not certified. It's a misuse because you don't know what you're doing. And he didn't put down the clamps. He didn't chalk the wheels. He parked on an incline. And there are pictures of the chocks. He just made careless mistake after mistake. Thank you very much.
Rebuttal?
It's not undisputed that the handle was 4 turns out of adjustment. Defense witness Thomas Free said it was 1 turn out of adjustment. That's JA 958 to 960. The brake came back fully adjusted, JA 1782. The citations I promised you, Justice McClanahan, I apologize, I'm over, were JA 393 to 94, 506, 923, 925 to 26. That is, the set screw design was feasible in 2003. See, I'm over. We respectfully ask
your
the court
time,
to reverse the
your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 20 minutes till 11.
All rise.
Go back.